From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For years now, Chase Peterson has been one of those constant presences on the campus of the University of Utah. Often you'll find him in a crimson V-neck sweater. He's taught at the medical school, he's practiced at the clinics on campus, and of course served as the school's president. Years ago, when he learned he had cancer, he started writing a book about his life. The cancer has subsided some, but he's kept at the project. His friend, the academic Cornel West, calls Peterson's book a classic American story of passionate curiosity for other parts of the world and a profound appreciation of one's roots. Peterson himself says the book is less a memoir than just a collection of stories. So today in the program, he'll join us to tell some of the stories of his personal and spiritual journey. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of Utah's most respected public figures is joining us today, Chase Peterson. Those of you here in Utah recognize the name, of course. He was the president of the University of Utah, among other positions he's held throughout his life. And he's found himself at the center of some of the state's biggest stories, the artificial heart, of course, the controversy over cold fusion. When he learned he had cancer some years ago, Peterson started to write a memoir, mostly, he said, to displace his sense of panic. The book he's finished is not a memoir necessarily from an academic, from a scientist, a physician. Peterson just calls it a collection of stories that shed light on his human and his spiritual journey. The book is called The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. And Chase Peterson is joining us today to talk about it. Dr. Chase Peterson was born and raised in Logan, Utah, served as Dean of Admissions at Harvard College, later as Vice President at Harvard University. In 1978, he returned to the West as Vice President for Health Sciences at the University of Utah. In 1983, he became the 11th President of the University, and it's a position he held for some 8 years. These days, Dr. Peterson is a Professor of Medicine at the University of Utah School of Medicine, and that's a lot to say. Chase Peterson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
A pleasure, Doug.
Well, I wanted to start, I guess, as you started thinking about this book. Did you always figure you would write a book like this?
Exactly the opposite.
Really?
I've never been a writer to speak of. I remember even tending to avoid classes in college that had large theme papers to write at the end. And I spent my life in communication orally, by and large, yeah. Not on the written page.
Yeah.
So I did it rather timidly. But once I got into it, I found it just fascinating.
Oh, the process?
The process.
Why?
Well, the newness, for one thing.
Huh.
I was encouraged to give David Cranes, a wonderful retired professor of English here, a few pages of what I started to write, see what he might say. And I was kind of scared to do so, but I did. And he called me back a few days and said, Chase, you got something here. You got to write it down, but it's going to be hard, but you got to do it.
Yeah.
He said, and by the way, could I make a suggestion? Try using commas and periods and commas and paragraphs from time to time. Suddenly I realized that when I'm giving a speech, I don't say, ladies and gentlemen, comma, it is a pleasure to be with you, comma. I went back and looked at what I'd shown him, and here was a whole page, single-spaced, with one comma in the page. He said, let the reader get a chance to take a breath.
Yeah.
So this was a new medium for me, and I just found it most rewarding to go back to my office in Research Park on a Saturday afternoon, 4 o'clock, and type away on the computer, which I came to enjoy the computer because it lets you get your ideas down quickly, and then you can go back and tidy them up if you need to.
Yeah.
And at 11:30 at night, you look down at your watch, and you haven't been to the bathroom, you haven't had supper, you've just been engrossed in what you're doing. That's a privilege.
Yeah. So finding out that you had cancer was it the trigger then?
I don't want to be too dramatic about it, but I came down with something called multiple myeloma, and it's supposed to kill you in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. And that was the prognosis, right?
Yeah, and that sobers you. And I thought to myself, okay, what do you need to get done? Well, you got to check your bank account. You got to check your will. You got a few things like that. But then I became more and more aware of a relationship I had to parents and grandparents. And I wanted to be sure that was not lost on my children or grandchildren. And so I began to write those as stories. And I was encouraged in the notion of a story as opposed to an essay.
Yeah.
By a wonderful another professor of English named Sidney Hyman, who's professor of English at the University of Chicago. He's the biographer of Mariner Eccles, of the Eccles family.
Right.
And he came out here one time. There was a dinner honoring Spence Eccles, and I had been asked to speak at it, and he was there. I didn't meet him or know him then. But bless the man, he called me the next day and said, Dr. Peterson, he introduced himself. He said, I heard your comments last night, and I want you to know that your stories are believable, and you need to write them down. Well, that was a good encouragement. And the notion that it could be stories rather than a sort of an academic thesis, so yeah. to speak, gave me more liberty. So, you know, just to start out, it begins with a trip we made, my wife and I made, to Bornholm Island off the coast of Denmark and Germany, where my grandparents came from.
Yeah.
And we tracked down in the little Lutheran church. They had joined the Mormon church in the meantime. A little note, 1856, gone to America.
Wow.
That's all they said. And then when they got here, they lived in Plain City, Utah for a short period of time. Didn't work out. They went to Baker, Oregon, where David Eccles, the father of Mariner, had a sawmill. And the word got around town of what my grandmother was doing for her children. And they were walking, and this was told to me by Mariner Eccles first, and then my father confirmed it. They were walking to church one day, and he put his arm around and he said, Sister Peterson, what's this I hear about you working your fingers to the bone, taking in boarders and doing laundries to raise money to send your children to college? Why, I'm not even sending my children to college. And she looked up and said, Brother Eccles, if I had your boys, I wouldn't either. Now, there's the American dream. 13 words. Gone to America. They were attracted by the religion of the matter. They're attracted by the promise of America.
Yeah.
Gone to America. And then a staunch mother that had every faith in those children. And not only the boys went to college, the girl went to college too.
Yeah.
And one of them was my dad.
You say early in the book that you, as you, I guess as you were writing this, laying this out, that you started to see patterns?
I did. One was the pattern of home. Part of the home is what I've just described, a grandmother who has such fierce determination for her children. The next home was my real home. Dad was president of Utah State, Agricultural College, now Utah State University.
Yeah.
And our home was right on campus. And as a 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old kid, I just assumed that I belonged there and I was part of the campus. And I marched with the marching band when they were practicing. The conductor even gave me a baton after a while I could use. I went out with the paint crew to paint. I'd do errands for them. They'd let me paint a little bit here and there. I did it so long, a couple of weeks or months or so, I finally thought I must be on the payroll. And I went to the payroll window at the end of the month. There I was, about 4 feet tall, reaching up to think, my name's Chase Peterson. And he said, we don't see any reference to, are you sure you're employed there? But that didn't bother me. And I went out with the crew that fed the cows and the horses out in North Logan on the days and so forth. So I just lived in that. People talk about it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
Well, that was the village. Let me give you another example of how much part of the village we were. My older sister, by 4, 5, 6 years, walked into a lecture being given by the Danish ambassador. And she and my father were on the stage, and she was talking. My sister walked in with 4 little friends, neighborhood friends, saw Dad on the stage, walked down the aisle, up onto the stage, found empty chairs, and she sat down and hoisted these little kids up onto the chair. And by that time, the audience was snickering a little bit because here the Danish ambassador was talking about the proper approach to the raising of children. And after listening for a short period of time, my sister got off the chair, went over to Dad, and whispered something in his ear. He reached in his pockets, came up with five dimes for the kids to go buy ice cream cones. They put them, they got off their chairs, they walked down, walked up the aisle, went off.
Oh, my God.
That's the home.
Yeah.
And when I ended up at, we can talk about some of these in-between stages, but
yeah, we will.
At age 14 or 15, I had left Utah on a scholarship to go to a prep school in New England. First Utahn, first Mormon kid to ever go there.
Yeah.
But as a sophomore at Harvard, where I ended up in college, it was a small class setting Harvard Business School case studies, but not for the economics, but rather the human relationships. And we got to know each other very well, like a T group, they used to call it in those days. And one day I was walking to class with the professor, and the subject of homesickness came up, and he knew I'd left home when I was 14 and so forth. And I thought, that's interesting, Professor Cabot. I don't ever remember being homesick. And without a second's pause, of course not. You brought your home with you. Huh. And that is profound.
Yeah.
To really go far forward, when I was president of the University of Utah, Ted Bell, a wonderful professor of education here, was asked to be Secretary of Education by Reagan. And we gave him the usual leave of absence letter and so forth. But I thought I'd do a personal letter. So I wrote him this letter, said, "Dear Ted, I want you to know how much we like you. You can come back tomorrow or 6 weeks from now or 10 years from now, and you've got your position saved here." Well, he stayed there 4 years. And when he came back, I was walking along the campus with him. He said, "Oh, Chase, by the way, I meant to tell you something." And he patted his rear pocket, his fanny. He said, "I kept your letter in my rear pocket. And I called it my go-to-hell letter, meaning if I was ever being pushed to do things that I didn't believe in by the Washington system, I could tell those birds back there, to hell with you, I'm going back to the University of Utah." And he said it allowed me to be more of who I was and allowed me to be a better Secretary of Education. Mm. So that's what home began to be. It was not restricting. Wasn't something that held me in. It's something that liberated me.
You know, it's interesting because it seems like your father, he's an example, I think, of this. Seems to me, was as I was reading this. Your father kind of ran afoul of some of state lead, the governor at the time,
uh-huh. Yeah.
Because he was not doing what the governor thought was, he wasn't emphasizing agriculture enough. Your father seemed intent on conveying liberal education to these kids, even at this agriculture college, and he got in trouble for it to some degree.
Let me enlarge on that,
yeah.
and give you the Peterson family view.
Okay, good.
The governor was otherwise a very fine man. He wanted the extension agents that were in each county of Utah under the Land Grant College Act to be appointed through his office, and Dad had been president for about 26 years up there. And he thought that was a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
That's an academic appointment, not a political appointment. He just said, "No, thank you, Governor." And so the governor, we, according to our view, packed the board with people that had been crossed by Dad over the years. In 3 or 4 years, they just announced all of a sudden, Dr. Peterson is being released as president. He was in his 28th year as president because of failure to emphasize agriculture enough.
Yeah.
Now, Dad read through the indictment, and he loved agriculture. One day I remember him bringing a head of lettuce home from the grocery store. It was wilted. Mother said, "E.G., couldn't you find a better head of lettuce?" He said, "Phoebe, if I hadn't bought it, nobody would have." And he had such respect for the farmer that raised that lettuce. In any case, he believed in agriculture, but he also thought that everyone who went to the farm ought to have exposure to a liberal education, yeah. to broaden their mind. But so he had the guts to say, after he'd been just fired, essentially, "I read the charge against me, and I find it inaccurate and inappropriate. Therefore, I choose not to leave." They could have changed the lock on the door. And there was things raged back and forth in the state, and they talked about it. And Johnny Fitzpatrick was head of the editorial department at the Salt Lake Tribune. He was the editor, I guess.
Yeah.
And he wrote a long article he summarized the case after a week. He said, the case against Dr. Peterson appears to be he's been too good too long. Bless his heart. He's a patron saint in our family.
Is that right?
Anyway, they compromised. Dad stayed on for another year
and
gave him time to get a new president, and everything was fine.
But this idea of liberal education, I mean, this expansive view of the world, that came from home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Expansive. And home became a base. It became a passport, essentially. Huh. Think about the Irish Americans that came to America and how readily they reached out for the best of America but kept their pride in Ireland and the St. Patrick's Day parade and everything else. And compare that to the failure, probably, of the Native Americans who were taken away from the tribe, sent back east to schools to make Americans out of them, but told they couldn't use their old language, they couldn't have their dances, they couldn't have their ceremonies. They cut out the base of those people, and the adjustment probably was never as good as it was for the Irishman.
Was it a pretty conventional religious upbringing? Your family was pretty Orthodox Mormon in many ways, but it seems like they had a kind of here as well. It seems like, because you write about it in the book, you say that it didn't seem terribly puritanical, for example, your brand of faith. And it seemed like you said you took the ideas of free agency and individuality, which you say gave you space to explore your faith.
Absolutely. I had space. I never felt constricted. Two quick stories then. My father off and on taught a Sunday school class while he was president. He came home one Sunday. I was 10, 11 years old. And he chuckled to me and said, "Son, Chase," whatever he called me, "don't ever sell short a church that puts each individual in charge of their own salvation." He said, at Sunday school today, before we could start the lesson, a man at the back of the room raised his hand, said, "Brother Peterson, I'd like to tell you that I've been thinking about our discussion last week, and I've been studying it, and I've been reading about it, and I've been praying, and I've decided that the Lord was right." That's sacrilegious, I suppose. But Dad just said, don't underestimate a faith that puts that responsibility. And this guy, by the way, was not a professor of philosophy.
Yeah.
He was a janitor of the local bank. Then later I remember an episode where my mother and my sister, the same sister that got the ice cream cone, had gone to a state conference, the annual meeting of the Mormon Church. And one of the talks was hell and damnation.
Yeah.
And my sister at age 14 was bristling about that and the harshness of it and so forth and complained to mother. And I was walking with them. I probably hadn't even listened to it very much. And mother said, I don't think I needed that today, but probably someone did. In other words, you're obliged to pick and choose, not discard or as a cafeteria, but choose. And she used to quote to me in letters when I was back in Boston as a young student, by a German philosopher. He was a theologian and a man who was an organist, Albert Schweitzer. He said, "One must first study the program in every way you can, from all angles and from all degrees. And when you've studied all you can, then you should pray about the matter, quiet the mind, and await the inspiration for which your study and your prayer has prepared you." Well, now, that's the religion I grew up in and still have, and it's a very powerful one.
Did you know what you wanted for your life early on? Did you map out a trajectory, you know, like a journey, a plan for yourself?
Absolutely not.
No?
Never had any ideas of becoming the plumber or the aircraft pilot or anything else. My mother came down with a osteomyelitis, infection of her bone, of her shin, before I was born. She lived in Lake Town. All they could promise her was amputation of the leg to save her life. She was about 12 or 15 or something. And she said, no, I'm going to keep my leg and we'll find a way to get through this. Well, the the infection went into a quiescent stage, which happens with bone infections sometimes. They've taken mummies from Egypt and chewed up the bones they find, and they can find living bacteria still hiding in these bones. But at age 34 or 5, it erupted again and broke out and actually broke through the skin. And she had exposed bone, shin bone there. When I was born, my memory is her propped up on the couch, her leg up. She would clean out the wound every day, dress it, even occasionally pick out spicules of dead bone to keep the thing cleaner. And she'd pat her leg and say, "My old friend." And she'd walked without a limp to speak of that I noticed, and it was there till the day she died. So that must have given me unconsciously some sense of that medicine was interesting. Medicine could be optimistic. Medicine could be forward-thinking. And that may have influenced me. I also was reasonably good in the sciences in school.
Yeah.
So I guess that encouraged me.
But she always told you, don't forget who you are.
Oh, bless her heart. From the earliest age, she used to say, "Chase boy, never forget who you are." And I didn't puzzle by that. I didn't really contemplate it because you don't contemplate things when you're 6 and 7 years old. But I never really knew what she meant because I didn't know who I was. But I did get the impression no one else will define you. You define yourself. And that's powerful.
Late spring of 1945, there came, you referenced it earlier, I wanted you to talk about it. It was this turning point in your life. You had received this kind of on a whim. You had taken this test.
I was in the ninth grade of junior high school. The principal came up and said, "Chase, well, I'd be interested to have you take a test. There's a school back east that wants some of our kids to take a test." For some reason, I didn't really know what. There was no obligation. I said, "Sure, I'd like to take tests. I'll do it.
Right.
A month later, a telegram arrived, which itself was quite an event in those days. You know, they were delivered by the little telegraph person
sure.
with a hat on, that I'd been awarded a scholarship to Middlesex School in Concord, Massachusetts. I later learned it wasn't Concord, it was Concord. It was Concord, not Concord. And I thought about it, and I looked about it, and Dad was leaving the college just that year. And I sensed that money was a little shut tight. We'd lived in a college home all his years, so we had no equity in a home to live in. They had to buy a new home to live in. His retirement fund couldn't have grown very well during the Depression. That was most of his presidency. And I just sensed that things were a bit tight, and even though I had a full scholarship, there'd still be expensive money to travel back and forth. And for that reason, and maybe others, I decided not to go.
Yeah.
He had a letter written by his secretary to thank the school and decline them with appreciation. He came over. He leaned against the mantle of our fireplace in our house. I'll never forget that scene. He said, "Let me read the letter, Chase, and see if it's okay." And he read this letter describing the decline. And he looked at me and said, "Are you sure you don't want to go?" And for reasons I didn't understand then, nor do I understand it now, I took a deep breath and said, "Dad, as a matter of fact, I do want to go." And that dear man tore up the letter in front of me, just zip, tore it up. He didn't say, "Are you sure?" or "Do you want to think about it?" or "Watch out for the painted ladies in Chicago when you go through on the train." If that wasn't a vote of confidence for a 14, 15-year-old kid, I'd like to know what was. And I look back to realize that I was never going to let my dad down or my mother down. And I went back. I thought I was Brigham Young going east as the first Mormon and first Utah to ever go to this school. I didn't really know what being a Mormon was at that age, but whatever it was, I was not going to embarrass him. And that began my self-discovery.
Chase Peterson is with us. His book is called The Guardian Poplar, A Memoir of Deep Roots, Journey, and Rediscovery. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Chase Peterson. We're talking about his new memoir. It's The Guardian Poplar, A Memoir of Deep Roots, Journey, and Rediscovery. I'm just going to lob you some opportunities to tell these stories, which is that's what it's all about. You talk about in the book how Harvard sort of set the stage for you considering your faith, but you say that there were these two forces that converged during your sophomore year at the school. One was this desire to, as you put it in the book, investigate the meaning of faith, and then there was that social pain of stuttering. You write about having begun stuttering, really, for some reason in the eighth or ninth grade, and this caused you some pain. And so you were sort of working through those two things. Talk about that.
Well, and there's a third thing, too. There was a man named Edward Ted Eyring, father of the current leader of the LDS Church, who was a professor of chemistry at Princeton. And he would come to Boston from time to time and meet with young LDS students, sort of fireside. And he made the simple point that there is no conflict between faith and reason. If there is, you haven't worked hard enough. And that's what he felt like as a chemist and so forth. Well, by the time I was a sophomore, I had been a passive, drifting Mormon, if you want to call it that. And I thought, come on, Peterson, it's time you better investigate this thing and make this your own or get rid of it.
Yeah.
And at that point, I'd been stuttering rather badly for the last 4 or 5 years for reasons I don't understand entirely. Doesn't really matter. But stuttering is a painful thing. Oh, you raise your hand in class, then you pull it down for fear that you won't be able to answer. In the dormitory, they holler, Peterson, phone, and you come down two flights of stairs to the payphone at the bottom of the dormitory. When you got to that payphone, you had to reach out for that damnable phone and say, ha, 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 hello. I learned the trick of going down the stairs doing calculus in my head, and I'd bump into the phone, grab it, and say hello before I lost my courage.
Because hello is particularly hard to say.
It is. It's a hello word. And so that combined with this determination to investigate what the meaning of faith was. And I remember, and I don't mean to sound too sweet or too pompous or anything else about this, but it's my life. I knelt down and prayed by the side of my bed in Winthrop House at Harvard College. I said, Dear Lord, if you exist and if we're on this earth to improve ourselves and to expand and grow, stuttering is an inefficient way for me to have to operate. Would you please help me find a way out of stuttering? Amen. I woke up the next morning. I've never stuttered since. Now, I'm enough of a neuroscientist to know what positive thinking can do and what a lot of different things and what brain channeling can do and so forth. We learned a lot about the fact that the brain kind of really remolds itself in response to the thoughts. Good thoughts create other better thoughts. But whatever it was, the stuttering disappeared. And that same faith that my sister and mother had choosing the power of what could be there in the mind as well as the spirit, was with me, and it's been a very powerful thing ever since.
Mm. So you don't see that conflict between reason and faith?
No. As a member of the church, I have disagreed with things that have gone on in the church. The church is fairly radical when you think about the fact that when we approved birth control many, many decades ago, the Republican Party is still fighting about it, apparently, in those debates, as if it's some kind of a thing that would allow women to have. Birth control and family planning is part of accepted practice in the LDS Church. I wasn't comfortable with our prohibition of blacks not getting the priesthood.
Let me hold you right there, because I want to ask you something about that. This was when you were in Boston, of course, and you'd been asked to be on what they call in LDS Church a stake high council.
Yeah.
But you had, as you said, you didn't agree with this position. You didn't know what to make of it. You had, I guess, pretty conflicted feelings about all of that. This was the prohibition of the LDS priesthood to men of color. But they asked you to be on this high council, and what did you say? It's an interesting response.
I went to the high council, head of the high council, and said I'd be honored to be on the high council with you, But you need to understand that I don't understand, and to the degree I do, I don't agree with our position. I think it will be changing in the church on the black priesthood matter. I'm not going to picket the church. I'm not going to burn buildings down. I'm not going to do those things. But I do want my understood that in discussions about that matter, I intend to be open and frank about it. If you would like me to be on the High Council with that attitude, I'd be honored to do so. He said, Chase, I'd be honored to have you on there. You'd be surprised how many people agree with you. And so that's where it was. Later on, I became a branch president. Yeah. And we had missionaries coming back from South America, Brazil, and places. And they said, we can't tell who's black. Everyone is black in Brazil. They've mixed up races and so forth. How can we live with this sort of thing? And President Kimball at that time had been battling, or as Schweitzer would say, studying from every way he could, discussing things with people from Africa about this position, praying in the temple hour after hour after hour for guidance and what would be inspiration and revelation on this matter. As a group of people in this little branch, we wrote a letter to him, a polite, humble letter, saying, laying out a position, saying why we thought it might change and why it could change.
What did it say? What did the letter say?
Well, we just said we think that we are a progressive church and the Lord is revealing new things to us and we're growing and expanding. And we hope that your prayers would be answered and you'd find reasons to feel we could move on in some fashion. I wrote that in April and I got a letter back a week later. Dear Brother Peterson, I've received your letter and I appreciate it. That's all he said. And then they announced the revelation on June 8th that year, and I got a letter from him a week later. Dear Brother Peterson, I assume you've heard the news and are as pleased as I am. Now, see, that's important. He was pleased to get the revelation. He wasn't someone pushing him. We weren't a bunch of nutheads in Cambridge pushing. He wouldn't respond to that, and we weren't doing that. But these good folks were praying, and he later said, prayer does not come to people lying on couches. You've got to work for your answers to your prayer. And he had worked and worked and worked and worked and satisfied himself and then satisfied his brethren.
How did you explain that position, that this was a group of fallible men who misconstrued the will of God?
This is historical inertia. Huh. The church began in the middle part of America. Slavery was an issue at that time. It was a hot issue, and that was just the customs of the time. And we moved west. The custom came with us, and there it was. Some people raised theoretical reasons why the black person couldn't get a thing, but none of them were convincing, and President Kimball never felt they were. It was evolution. And if you believe in a loving God who believes in the development and growth of his children, so to speak— that's entirely appropriate.
I want to ask you about when you decided, this comes before this, but when you decided you wanted to be a doctor, making that call, what was the clincher for you? You reflected back on your mother's experience and there was something there, but what was the thing that made you decide this was what you wanted to do?
I don't know. And we asked people that apply to medical school, tell us why you want to go to medical school in essays, and I don't know what I would have written. I was pretty good in the sciences. I saw in medicine a field which had intense human relationships, which I found attractive, yeah. The promise of that. It was obviously a do-gooding thing. It wasn't tearing down society. It was building up individuals. So it just seemed like a logical thing to do. And I didn't decide until I was a junior in college. I stayed over in the summer and took the summer school courses and then applied the next year and was admitted.
What was the other option? Was there another?
Can't think of any.
Is that right?
Yeah. No, can't think of any. Just seemed natural. And I had to work very hard. I was not a science major. And some of my classmates were practically PhDs in biochemistry. But that was a good challenge, and that was all right.
You know, it's interesting, Chase, to hear you talk about science in the context of relationships, and having spoken with you before, there's always some bit of art that you're thinking of. There's music and there's literature, and it's all, which is interesting for some scientists, I think.
Well, absolutely. I mean, music, we've discovered music influences the brain. I've gone down to the Utah Symphony some Friday evening, tired, worn out. I sometimes get jittery legs when I get really tired and so forth. And a Shostakovich symphony came on, something I hadn't heard before. I wouldn't be naturally a fan of his. It's a little bit too modern for me. And that thing just took me over. It absolutely overwhelmed me. And it went on, and I was just part of it by the time it was over. So music's part of it. I've had the great privilege of being able to work with medical students since I left the presidency. And I advise them to do two special little things, please. One, when you examine a patient, touch them. Some people treat a patient like a septic, something that they hold out at a distance and push the stethoscope out on their chest to listen to the lung. Put your hand on their shoulder, not in a vulgar way, but just let you know there's a human bond there. Secondly, learn something non-medical from each patient you see. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, the more you know about a patient, the more you can relate that to what their medical symptoms are. But furthermore, well, it is also fun to learn.
Yeah.
You see all these patients, you learn enormous amounts of new things. But most importantly, the patient says, he's bonding with me. He's listening to me enough to understand, try to understand who I am and where I come from. And if he's willing to learn from me, then I better be willing to learn from him when he prescribes medicines and different procedures to follow. So that's the human side of medicine, and it happens to be good humanity, and it's very good science.
As we head into a break, I wanted to ask you, what is it about Mahler's Second Symphony that inspires you so much, the Resurrection?
I went there alone one night. My wife was on a trip with some friends into Nevada on a discussion they were having. I never heard this Mahler symphony before, but it was deep and it was probing, and it just enveloped me in ways that I can't describe in words. Remember leaving, and as I left, there was a man seeking funds, a beggar outside, and I remember I gave him some coins from my left pocket. And when I got home, I thought, why didn't I give him that $5 bill I had in my right pocket? I just don't know. But at any rate, I got home and my wife Greta was gone. She was in Nevada. And I woke up the next morning lonely, just deeply lonely in the absence of Greta, thinking that somehow there might be something almost ultimately permanent because one of us would die and we might be separated. And I just came to feel that night, inspired by Mahler, that love cannot exist without the potential for loneliness. The more you love someone, the more lonely you are in their absence. And it deeply impressed me and deeply rebound myself to the love that I have for Greta and I believe Greta has for me. But it was triggered by Mahler. And the symphony. It's music is neurological as well. All cultures have music. They're all influenced that way. I could never live in a town that didn't have a symphony or a good car to get to one.
Chase Peterson is with us. His book is The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Chase Peterson. We're talking about his book, The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. Why did you want to be president of the University of Utah? Somebody put that question to you. You thought that was a pretty good question.
I've answered, I don't know, about five of your questions so far, Doug, and this was another one. I had huge respect for a university. Obert Tanner used to say that the university is the highest element of human development, or something like that. It's a place where you preserved old knowledge and you gained new knowledge. And to be involved in that was just an enormous privilege. And so I think I kind of took a deep breath and said, I wonder if I can do it. And I decided, yeah, I can do it. Off we went.
You tell of receiving, this is the first month or so into the job, and you tell in the book about receiving this phone call, someone who mentioned that, President Peterson, there's a problem. There's a gay lesbian conference that's being planned for the campus, and, you know, what do you plan on doing about it?
Well, you see, you ask yourself, what power does the president have? Not much. I didn't have stock dividends I could give anybody. I couldn't put someone in jail. You had the bully pulpit. And I remember getting that phone call, I think very quickly, Peterson, this is a big thing. You better think this through clearly right now. So I turned to this on the phone and said, well, let me think of what options do I have. I suppose I could find the names of the students that were organizing the conference and have them fired from the university. But they'd sue me immediately and be back quickly. Or I could find some faculty members might have been coaching them, and I could have them fired from their tenure. But they'd sue and win quickly and be back. Now, it's not against the law to practice homosexuality or heterosexuality with consenting adults. It's against the law to do it on the front lawn of the park building, but it's not by themselves. I went on with a few more options. Finally, there was a pause, and this fellow said, well, maybe the best thing might be to do nothing. And I deliberately paused for a moment and said, you know, that's probably the right answer. Well, the university had a perfectly decent discussion period, a convocation, if you want, on that issue. It deserved discussion, no one was seduced by it one way or the other, and it went on fine. But the university is a bastion of free speech, and that's where people have to be able to talk about ideas and not be afraid of them. And this was one of them.
Yeah. The cold fusion controversy, you write up a great deal about this in the book. And you mentioned that the criticism that accompanied all of that, the story itself, it became to some quite embarrassing for the university. And you say it kind of triggered a fear on the campus for some. What was going on, do you think?
It
did.
Well, if excess heat was being produced by the Pons-Weissman phenomenon, they didn't know why, and no one knew why. There was conjecture that it was some newer form of nuclear fusion, but you couldn't really explain it. And so it violated the laws. And people that were in charge of maintaining standards, so to speak, rose up and said, this is nonsense. And this is an example of conjugate principles. That is, two important principles in collision. One is free speech and the right to write what you believe. And the other is the need to maintain order in science and not have every cockamamie idea come out in the newspapers the next day saying that tomato juice will cure athlete's foot. So you see a collision there. And so the people in charge of maintaining order felt they had to speak out and be against it. There was also a political issue. Hot fusion was being studied intensively by the research community in the hopes of reproducing the conditions on the sun that could then provide power for this Earth. There had been no breakthroughs, and it was being funded year by year by Congress. And obviously, some people, I learned from them, felt very threatened that if some cold fusion thing came along that could be done cheaply, it might threaten the funding of hot fusion. The head of the Cavendish Lab at Cambridge, I met with him one time on another reason. And I finally asked him, what will it take to get the study of cold fusion into the mainstream of science? And he looked at me and smiled in a kind of a sly way and said, the hot fusion industry has a very strong lobby. And that's all it was said. Well, we still don't know what it is. Yeah. Hundreds of labs have reproduced the heat. No one still knows exactly why. And no one has been able to produce it commercially, although a number of laboratories from here to Israel and back are working on it very hard. But it's the phenomenon of the heat is real, And right as of today at MIT, there's a professor at MIT who for a long while has been trying to figure out what the mechanism might be that would explain the extra heat. And he's giving a course now, unofficially at MIT, on considering different possibilities. MIT insists it be unofficial, but he's doing it.
The university's faculty senate passed a resolution of, I'm not sure exactly, no confidence, but that's what you've sort of seemed it was expressing, a kind of a displeasure about how you were handling the matter. And you talk about that being a trigger for you to leave.
The university was, a lot of people did their best to embarrass the university for this outrageous thing that they're proposing. And a lot of people were sensitive about that. They thought the university might be harmed. Incidentally, the evidence is no harm at all. The amount of research we were doing in that year was something like $120 million. We're now doing $400 million worth of research per year, funded research from the national thing. Our recruitment of faculty had never been better, so there's been no harm. But at the time, there are a lot of people that were chagrined and a little embarrassed. And people laughed at Hick, Utah out there. One man even said, "I tend to be suspicious of scientific information that comes out of the Vatican or Salt Lake City." So that was all there. And so I had found myself in a position where I felt I had to say certain things. I was asked to testify at Congress about this matter. And incidentally, the man opened the hearing at Congress saying, "The announcement here was orthodox. It was not preceded by peer review." Well, it was, and that was held against us. It was peer-reviewed, but it was peer-reviewed in the Journal of Electrochemistry, Electroanalytic Chemistry, which was the journal that Fleischmann related to. And that didn't count if it was doing something that the physics community should be doing by itself. So anyway, the battle was going on. There was no real way to wipe away the turmoil. It was distracting from what was going. I've been at the university a good while. I was 1 year away from retiring, and I came home and said, "Greta, I think it's probably time for us to move on." Not with bitterness or anything else, but great appreciation, quite frankly. And so we announced that I was going to retire, but I would retire a year from now, giving them a full year to find a good new man to replace me. And I think it's worked out just fine.
Did you feel hurt?
A little.
Yeah.
I'm human. I'd like everyone to love me. And some people were mad at me. But at the same time, free speech has never sailed on tranquil waters. There's usually a few waves to bump up against.
I want to come back around, as you do, to this idea of, you know, you come back around where you started. And there's a reference to it. T.S. Eliot, I wanted you to talk about this in the book. Read this section, if you would, from your book.
Well, as I intimated, the writing of the book was a discovery process for me. I discovered more about myself, about my ancestors, about grandparents that homesteaded land in Bear Lake. I worked there every summer. And so this was a moment of – this was a process of discovery for which I was grateful. But I became so overwhelmingly moved by the power of the sense of home – and the power of the sense of culture. Why did those things not restrict me?
Yeah.
And this is how I end the book, if I may read it. "My journey includes the way, as a doctor, I became a patient." That was the cancer that had me disturbed for a while. "The milestones are both institutions and people. The institutions enriched me and provided a platform for my ideas, while they challenged me to remember who I was apart from them. As with the first pulse, the end of my journey returns to my parents and our family's deep roots. This starting place, Logan, Utah, informs the beginning, the course, and the end of my story." T.S. Eliot's familiar line says as much, "And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." This leads me to ask, did deep roots shrink or enlarge opportunity, dampen or strengthen courage? Did they narrow or broaden curiosity or imagination? Did they constrain or free the mind and spirit? I hope those who read these stories will find the answer, if not mine, then their own.
Chase Peterson. His book is The Guardian Poplar, a memoir of deep roots, journey, and rediscovery. Dr. Peterson, thank you very much.
A pleasure, Doug. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.